Scalpel. Blood bucket. Priest. Next patient.
Gee, Zoidberg, leave some for the enemy to kill.
Leave Dr. Zoidberg alone. He has twice the training you do.
Yeah, he's a doctor and a butcher.
Oh, see, this is how it starts. First with the jokes, then comes the heavy stuff.
When will the killing end?
This is The Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 331, for the week of November 30th, 2020. I am Poop in a Bobby Hat, David T. Cole, and I'm here with the longest goodbye, Sarah D. Bunting.
Cut.
And 46-year-old high school freshman, Tara Ariano.
I've never had caramel on a potato before.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great, special episode coming at you this week. It is an all-canon episode. Three canon pitches from you, the listeners, chosen by us, the panel. Let's get right to it. Show number one.
Doctors fighting against the clock to save lives in the face of insufficient supplies. People living in constant fear, separated from their families, drinking to numb the pain, subject to the whims of questionably motivated government officials. Sound familiar? Yes, that's right. I'm talking about one of the funniest TV comedies of the 1970s and 80s. In these uncertain times, we're all on the lookout for television comfort food, and I've found myself gravitating toward MASH. And not just because I, like Klinger, am experiencing an inexplicable longing for my hometown, Toledo, Ohio. The early years are silly fluff, but the later seasons are surprisingly relevant to our current pandemic situation, and as I watch my daily episode, or five, I find myself crying as often as laughing. Even though I hadn't been born yet when Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen aired, yes, I know, I'm a baby, it was a cultural phenomenon, and it belongs in the canon. This nearly two-hour-long episode was the 256th episode of the series and, with an audience of over 100 million people, held the record of most-watched television broadcast from its airing in 1983 until it was unseated by Super Bowl XLIV in 2010. As the episode opens, Hawkeye is in a psychiatric ward for a nervous breakdown of mysterious origin while everyone else is hard at work patching up the troops as the peace talks get serious and the fighting heats up. Through Dr. Sidney Friedman's careful questioning, we see how Hawkeye's brain has repressed his memories of the traumatic incident that sent him spiraling and eventually uncover the horrific truth.
I didn't mean for him to kill it! I just wanted it to be quiet! It was a baby! She smothered her own baby! You son of a bitch, why did you make me remember that?
His demons identified, if not fully exorcised, Hawkeye is sent back to the 4077, and things are as chaotic as usual, but we do get reminders of the importance of washing our hands.
Just a minute.
You handle our food and dig latrines?
Don't worry, sir, I always wash my hands before I dig the latrines.
And not touching our faces.
A complete professional in OR. Unlike some people I know who do not know how to obey the slightest rules of maintaining sterility.
Oh, no, you don't. We settled that a long
time ago. I know what I saw.
You saw nothing.
You touched
because
your
that did
nose.
Not I did
you
not.
You couldn't keep your
I
hands
did not
off
touch
of
my
it.
Nose.
You are obsessed with your nose. You have a nasal obsession.
Just a minute.
Then finally it comes, the moment we've been waiting 11 years for. It's only been three to the characters, but as we're all learning now, perception of time becomes more, fluid in the face of a crisis.
Ladies and gentlemen, 5 minutes ago at 10:01 this morning, the truce was signed in Panmunjom. The hostilities will end 12 hours from now at 10 o'clock. The war is over!
And so the wrapping up begins. The episode is too long to cover everything, but suffice it to say, all of the characters get appropriate send-offs, sometimes joyful, sometimes bittersweet, just like the show itself. With the camp coming down around them, the main players exchange heartfelt goodbyes, and in the final moments of the episode, we get the culmination of one of the greatest bromances ever to hit the small screen, as Hawkeye and Beach say their farewells. More than that, they sum up how we all feel about leaving this show and these people after more than a decade.
Look, I know how tough it is for you to say goodbye, so I'll say it. Maybe you're right. Maybe we will see each other again. But just in case we don't, I want you to know how much you've meant to me. I'll never be able to shake you. Whenever I see a big pair of feet or a cheesy mustache, I'll think of you.
Whenever I smell month-old socks, I'll think of you.
And the next time somebody nails my shoe to the floor.
Yeah, well, when somebody gives me a martini that tastes like lighter fluid.
I miss you.
I'll miss you. A lot. I can't imagine what this place would have been like if I hadn't found you here.
As Hawkeye's helicopter takes off, he sees BJ has arranged stones on the ground to spell out the word goodbye. This is neither the best nor the most representative episode of this influential series. I'll leave it to others to submit those. It is, however, the most memorable, not to mention one of the best known and most watched television episodes of all time. Just like the residents of the 4077, we won't make it through this unimaginable time without catastrophic losses and deep collective trauma, but someday it will be over, and those of us who are left will be able to return to our lives and to our new normal, forever changed and with a new appreciation for risks taken, kindnesses shown, and freedoms previously taken for granted.
Thank you, Lindy. Sarah, you picked this. Why don't you start? And if you can keep your arguments under 2 hours, we'd all appreciate it.
I will try. Thank you so much, Lindy. That presentation was excellent. Not to mention done with rather more dispatch than the episode. Yes, I did pick this one because I had just been thinking sort of idly to myself recently, like, you know, it's a little surprising that we haven't contemplated this episode yet, given that it's like the go-to reference for a bygone time where everybody in the country was watching the same thing. And I remember where I was not watching it, but I was sleeping over at a friend's house, and her mom basically made it known that if we needed anything during the finale, that was tough shit and we should like call 911 ourselves. She wasn't to be disturbed.
Good for her.
Yeah. I mean, she was like that about a lot of Friday night TV, but this, like, we knew she was serious and would hit us with a spoon. Shout out, Mrs. Hine. I hope you're well. So yeah, I picked this and I was like, we really should discuss it on the merits. And then I pull it up on Hulu and I was like, 1:59:30. I mean, it's really long. It's really self-indulgent. I'm willing to grade on a curve for finales in which scenes have been put in so that the actors can say goodbye to each other. Like, right. I'm okay with that. But, 2 hours sans commercials, and then Alan Alda, who directed, gets in one last Emmy reel on his way out the door. Like, there's just a lot of acting, some of it from actors for whom I have never cared. Loretta Switch.
Oh, God.
She's just like, it's a very binary method of acting, yelling and not yelling. Mm-hmm. Not a fan. But the thing is, this is not here. Like, we're not talking about it. Like, qua episode. And so I'm interested to hear what everybody else thinks of its canon chances just as being that go-to reference. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm interested to hear what Tara thinks. I mean, as television, the other thing is I'm not steeped in MASH lore. Like, I was not a regular watcher. I haven't watched it. I love the movie. Mm-hmm. So I don't have necessarily this context of saying farewell. I think that couching the presentation, like paralleling it with our current situations globally, was really smart and sort of gives me pause, but I'm not sure it's enough. Like this was really a slog to watch. I'm so sorry to say.
Yeah. Sometimes you can't go back home. Eh? I mean, I remember this was a thing. I mean, I was 11 at the time, so I probably didn't give a shit because what 11-year-old's actually going to watch MASH for real. And if they are, understand it for what it is. But oh my God, that was just so self-indulgent and so like loud in his intentions. Like the whole thing where it starts off and Hawkeye is in the shrink ward and they're not letting him out. He really wants to get out and they're like delivering the backstory piecemeal, sort of like one man Rashomon style, where he slowly recovers his memories, where it wasn't a chicken that he was yelling at the lady to shut up because there was enemies nearby and their bus was out in the open. It turned out it was a baby and she smothered the baby and oh my God, it smothered the baby.
And that's only a quarter of the way through. Like I thought that was the big reveal at the end. I mean, I knew that plot point going in, but
no doubt it was a punch to the gut.
Sure.
The problem is it just the way it was delivered, where he's like talking to the doctor that resurfaced it, it's like so over the top and it's so almost a parody of itself now. Like we heard the thing with the Futurama, like it sounds like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hawkeye is that character, but still this episode, oh God, that whole thing with the, you know, with the recovered memories.
Should not have directed himself. Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right to phrase it in terms of like, you can't go home again. Like this episode would not be made this way today with good reason.
And, you know, I am not a crackpot, but I think that a TV show is to stick to its format for its finale. It's been, if you are a half hour sitcom or dramedy, produce a finale that is a half hour sitcom or dramedy. I feel like it's a service to the way you write and the way that things move, because, you know, if you're going to put in 2 hours what you usually put in an episode and a half or two episodes, it's going to show, and it does.
Yeah.
And there are beats that are on repeat that are sort of like stalled in the middle until they go to resolution. Like there is a band of five Chinese soldiers that are now POWs at the camp, and Charles wants to teach them to play Mozart on the various instruments that they were carrying around. And all fine and good. That's very MASHy and true to the show. But like there is the first instance of that meeting. And then there are 12 things where they're trying to play and failing. And then there's the end where they're saying goodbye or they're getting trucked off and they finally play it right, you know, as Charles waves them goodbye. That could have been like 4 beats instead of like 8 beats or whatever it was. And that seems to be like this episode expands in the middle. I'm not a fan of the whole Hawkeye storyline. I will say that like the last 20 minutes when they're actually saying goodbye felt kind of real. I mean, I guess, you know, they've been doing this for 11 years.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I was saying. But
with certain combinations, you kind of felt like this was them actually saying goodbye, and it elevated that. And, you know, the way they mix the characters, everybody kind of said goodbye to everybody else and everybody had their own sort of take on it. I thought that was well done. And that's what I would definitely needs to be a part of the finale, is everybody saying goodbye. But boy, everything before that, it really didn't age well. It is really self-indulgent, like Sarah says, and it is expanded in the middle to the point of like boredom. Even though like there's like this really like gut punch plot point, still doesn't work. So I would say like I enjoyed the actual actor combinations at the end. Potter Klinger, Hawkeye Beach, and you know, all these things. And you know, we all know Colonel Potter really wants to fuck that horse before he leaves Korea.
Yeah. I thought he was good throughout. He was good. Whenever he was in a scene,
the one person who
like,
cried that I bought, he was crying for real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brutal. Like, I mean, Lindy is right when she says it was a cultural phenomenon, and it was at the time. But that's not, I mean, Sarah, to your point, going into our responses, like, while that was true then, that doesn't mean that we can't, that doesn't mean we can't evaluate it as a piece of television now. Like, we have to.
That Super Bowl superseded its audience numbers, that could have been the most boring football game ever, doesn't mean anything that a lot of people tuned into.
Yeah, I mean, I acknowledge that this was a big, it hit different at the time, because TV was different at the time, and culture was different at the time, and like, those beats would have been, you know, more meaningful because that it would have been different from any kind of other show like that. Obviously, now we have a huge panoply of different kinds of shows, and, you know, we are able to calibrate them to different degrees of subtlety in ways that you couldn't when there were three networks plus PBS, you know, and I get that. Mm-hmm. And so when you want to make one final statement about what war is like, and this is your very last chance, and you're Alan Alda, and you directed it and are in it, and you're one of the 18 people that wrote it, judging by the credits, like, you know, you might feel like this is your last stand. But, oh, that scene is so embarrassing to watch. Like, it just, I can't send myself back to watch it in the context of the time. All I can do is evaluate it now. And, like, it's rough.
It feels like something that would have been in some, like, acting school in 1985. Like, let's do the mass scene now.
Oh, my
remember,
God.
Yeah.
And the number of sitcoms it felt like that had this were going to be serious with the shrink thing.
Mm-hmm.
Family ties. Like,
although I did like the shrink. Not...
Yeah, the shrink is good. I thought that
character wasn't as one dimensional as you would suspect he would be. And he was acted really well.
Yes, he is good. Sarah already brought up Loretta Swit's quote performance unquote. Like there's one scene when she's trying to do it. She wants to send a telegram and she's yelling at Klinger. And then Potter comes in and he's yelling at Klinger. It's like, all of you are in this very small tent. Everyone stop screaming again to the Futurama. It's like, stop yelling. This is not Zoidberg directing his movie.
Pull rank, Potter.
Exactly. Like, she's so one note. And also, I was like irrationally furious about how not period her haircut is. Like, she's just out here with a fully 80s haircut in what is supposed to be the Korean War. Like, a little effort. I mean, just put it in a ponytail. That would have made a difference. Like, whatever. The whole thing with Klinger and his girlfriend, I guess, who eventually marries him at the end. Rosalind Chow, baby Rosalind Chow, who I saw in a movie last year, and still looks exactly the same, basically has not aged, is agelessly gorgeous. But her reward for getting through this ordeal is Klinger. Like, okay. I was also irrationally angry that despite her being a refugee who's like running all over the country trying to find her parents, her one and only outfit, as far as we can tell, gets 0% dirty. It's like, guys, can you a little verisimilitude? Like, come on, try. But, you know, I think the storyline of like this, the power imbalance between the two of them and like that this is their happy ending. It's like, OK, for him, for her, maybe like let's check back in with them in 10 years and see how that worked out. Maybe. I don't know. I enjoyed seeing Colin's lawyer from 90210 as MacArthur in the psych asylum. Hi to that guy. That actor is now deceased. But yeah, Dave already said about how much the storylines, because the episode is like so protractedly long, the plot lines do too, and we keep revisiting them. He already mentioned the band thing, but the whole thing with Hot Lips intervening to get him the job at the hospital. It just keeps coming back to that. And it's the same thing over again, where it's like he's proud and she's proud. And we know how it's going to end. They're going to make peace as soon as the book comes out and he demands it back. We know what's going to happen with the fucking book at the end. And then it does. It's like all of that is completely predictable, too.
And the search for the parents.
Yeah.
I feel like she left the camp to search for her parents four times.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Lindy pointed to the last scene between BJ and Hawkeye, and they are great. That was the only relationship and the only performances that I bought is the two of them interacting with each other. That Mike Farrell, he really boils my potatoes, to quote The Simpsons. R.I.P. to him as well. I believe we have lost him. The rest of it, it's exhausting. And just out of curiosity, I looked it up, and the movie, MASH, is shorter than this episode by 3 minutes. It's not an episode. It really is 5 episodes back to back to back to back to back. And it doesn't, to me, for that reason, it does not hold together. Like, if we were considering the last 20 minutes, maybe, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about this huge bloated affair. And it is to me. So,
yeah. I will end by saying, if you want to tackle a MASH episode with very similar themes, the one you want to check out is called Abyssinia Henry. And that is the finale of the 3rd season. And that is the one where Colonel Blake is shipped off. He's getting out. And then right at the end, they find out that his helicopter or a plane, whatever it was, was shot down over the Sea of Japan or something like that. And that's just like a gut punch, even more personal. You know, it wasn't just Hawkeye's character, you know, that was affected. I felt like that is the episode that this episode wanted to be.
Yeah.
And could have been, but it wasn't. Yeah. So let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you?
I mean, I'm really tempted to say yes, but I mean, like there is some good stuff in here, but resubmit with a different episode that's more, you know, not 10 years long. Yeah, this is a no. Sorry. Good presentation, though.
All right. Getting to that point, I feel like this is like, just because it's classic and renowned. I mean, that, remember the I Love Lucy episode?
I was thinking about that today, too.
I feel like it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes they just don't age well.
They don't.
And you watch it today, and it's just not up to snuff. Yeah. What do you say?
Things don't always hold up. And this is an example of that. So it's a no for me, too. But thank you, Lindy, for your submission.
All right. No for me, too. So that means MASH, Season 11, Episode 16, Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen. You are hereby not inducted into the Extra. All right, it's number 2. This is Tara's pick. Let's hear that argument.
Let's flash back to the very end of the 20th century when we were witnessing the rise of cable TV shows where the protagonist was an anti-hero. In particular, we're going to be talking about an iconic anti-hero from the suburbs of New York. No, not the one you're probably thinking of, but one Jerry Blank. I'm submitting for the canon Strangers with Candy, Season 1, Episode 7 or 8, depending on where you find it, named Feather in the Storm. For those of you not familiar with the show, Strangers with Candy is a series created by Amy Sedaris, Paul Dinello, Stephen Colbert, and Mitch Rouse, and ran from 1999 to 2001 on Comedy Central. It's basically a parody of 1970s and 80s after-school specials and TV movies of the week. Jerry, played by Sedaris, is a 46-year-old who returns to high school after being in prison for 32 years for stealing a TV and for being a self-described boozer, user, and loser. I don't want to waste time explaining the real-life inspiration for the character, but I encourage you to look into it if you're not familiar. I also want to say at the top that Strangers with Candy is not very PC, nor was it even at the time it aired. In fact, I was on the fence about submitting the episode, but I really love some of the scenes and jokes. However, I understand mileage may vary about the subject matter, humor, and language in the episode. Some of it may not have aged well, so the EHG crew and listeners may disagree with me on this being canon-worthy for that reason. This particular episode is a parody of specials about anorexia, specifically the most 1981 made-for-TV movie ever called The Best Little Girl in the World, which stars Jennifer Jason Leigh, Charles Durning, Eva Marie Saint, and Melanie Mayron. Yep, 1981, all right. The full movie is available on YouTube. The 70s light folk rock I'm Okay, You're Okay song that you hear on various radios throughout the episode, expressing Jerry's feelings, that's a parody of Joni Mitchell's Songs to Aging Children Come, which is used in the TV movie. Please play clip 1.
You are large and quite obese.
In a nutshell, Jerry feels like nobody listens to her or pays attention to her. So she decides to try out for the debate team at Flat Point High, but is ridiculed at every turn for not having the right body type for the debate team. She is scoffed at by faculty advisor Chuck Noblet, played by Colbert, while he is inexplicably frying enough food at his desk to rival a Bennigan's. Clip two.
Mr. Noblet, can I talk to you? Can I have a shrimp tempura?
No, Jerry, what is it?
Well, I want
Jerry, make this quick. I'm frying things, okay?
I wanted to sign up for the debate tryouts.
You think that's such a good idea, Jerry?
I don't know. I think it's a good way to get attention. And can I have a jalapeno popper?
No. Look, you don't exactly have what I'd call a debater's body. Slim arguments come from slim hips.
She's also mocked by other students trying out for the team, including Lizzie, played by Ellen Pompeo, but does manage at least one classic Jerry Blank clapback. Clip three.
Jerry, it's almost feeding time. Shouldn't you be stampeding toward the feeding trough?
Whoa!
I got a better idea, Lizzie. When the lunch bell rings, why don't you eat me?
Bang! Bang! That was a very slender retort, Jerry.
In addition, her family and family meat man, Stu, played by David Pesquisi, ridicule Jerry for not having the right body type for the debate team. Stu, ahead of the keto-paleo trend, thinks Jerry should cut down on carbs and eat more meat. They get into an epic argument at the dinner table, including an amazing God damn it, a signature of the show from Pesquisi, and a great bit of physical comedy as Jerry pegs Stu with a biscuit as she leaves the dinner table. Clip four.
I'm trying to lose a few pounds.
You are a constant source of joy and amusement.
Here's a good one. Jerry's trying to lose some weight.
No, but seriously, if you lose a little gristle off the haunches, you're going to turn into quite a cute little lamb chop.
Yeah?
So lighten up on the rolls and butter and go heavy on the brisket.
I'm not hungry.
Why don't you try the brisket?
I don't want any brisket.
Stu, don't waste your time. You're beating a fat horse.
Eat the brisket.
I don't want any brisket.
God damn it! I'll handle this guy.
Come on.
I bust my hump all day long so you can have food on this table and you're gonna eat it!
You're not my father!
You're not my daughter! Pick up your meat and go to your room!
No, I hate you!
I hate you too!
Come on, Suki!
Was I out of line?
No. Good biscuit blocking.
Art teacher Mr. Jelinek, played by Danilo, catches on to Jerry's situation and encourages her not to engage in some of the risky behaviors associated with eating disorders. But his advice backfires and Jerry descends into a spiral of binging and purging, pills, and not eating. He and Noblet stop by the Blank house and he has a contentious conversation with the Blanks and Stu over Jerry's situation. I hope nobody has a beef with the meat puns in clip five.
If you think this is my fault, just say so.
Simmer down, Stu.
I'm just so angry.
Obviously you have a beef, Stu, but please don't stir things up. If we don't help Jerry now, she can become a vegetable.
Baloney.
Let him talk.
Him who?
Him me. Please, Mrs. Blank, I suggest family counseling.
I think it's best that you leave.
I've got to run. But as soon as you're ready to talk about your family problems to an art teacher, you can call me.
After Jerry collapses at debate tryouts, Jelinek revives her by snapping an uncooked hot dog in front of her nose, and he stages an intervention with her family and Stu. Noblet comes in to announce that Jerry did not make the debate team, but in True Strangers with Candy form, there's a warped lesson to the end because everyone is there and actually paying attention to Jerry. The gang celebrates by eating Jerry's pet of the week, Suki, a Japanese silky chicken. You might think this is going to be a misdirect like in the Golden Girls episode where they think Sophia's sister cooked Count Bessie the showbiz chicken, but nope. Suki apparently sacrificed herself to prove a point to Jerry. Strangers with Candy was an influential show, and I believe it deserves a place in the canon. I chose this episode because it has many of the hallmarks of the early episodes of the series, including a very specific parody of a movie of the week, nods to the relationship between Noblet and Jelinek, and Jerry perving on Tammy Littlenut, just to name a few. I hope you enjoyed this episode and will consider inducting Strangers with Candy into the Extra Hot Great canon.
Thank you, Tim, for that submission. I picked this off the list. We watched Strangers with Candy on DVD. This is how long ago it was, because I don't think anywhere aired it in Canada where we lived at the time, but we had read that it was sounded like it was our sort of thing. And I remember watching a bunch of episodes of season one and feeling like, when is this going to lock in? And eventually it did. And I believe it was an episode with something involving the principal and a squirrel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Not this one.
No.
But yeah. This one is also very good. Tim is right. There are a couple of lines where it's like, ooh, that here, it's hits the ear hard. There's a couple of slurs that I do not even feel comfortable repeating as examples to say what they are. So he is right about that. But I think overall, the spoofiness of it, as he said, I think carries the message across. And Ellen Pompeo as the bitchy, skinny debate girl is very funny. She really has a talent for comedy, which she did more of before she was Meredith Grey on Grey's Anatomy. I'm so glad that he clipped the dumb back and forth meat and food puns. Example,
same.
It's like, as I've said many times, we love smart comedy. Smart comedy is great. Dumb comedy is also great. And that was a good example where it's like, there's just no reason to do that, but why not? And
I also like right at the end of that whole exchange is, if you ever want
to. Yes, yeah. I was just getting to that, okay. Where the end of it is, like, if you ever want to talk about your family problems to an art teacher,
look
me up, because it's just a nod at like, we have the budget to pay 8 actors, and so they have to do everything, which is why it's the art teacher that is intervening in this situation. I mean, you know, it starts from a very reasonable premise of, you know, eating disorders are a big deal in high school for girls, but then spins out from like, why would you need to be thin to be on the debate team? It just goes from there.
That's kind of a genius.
It really
twist
is good.
On it, though. I really.
It, that's what I mean. That's what makes it
smart,
funny.
Dumb.
And yes, and you know, they all started in sketch. This is basically a sketch show spun out into sitcom form. It was a great presentation. Really funny, stupid episode that I enjoyed watching. So thank you, Tim, for the submission, Sarah. Oh, one more thing. Sorry, I forgot. Sorry to interrupt you. When Dave played the clip where we hear the signature song with the in Spanish with Gordo, Gordo, Gordon was sitting, our dog, whose name is Gordon, was sitting on the couch between us. And when they started singing Gordo, he looked up as though they were calling his name. Okay, Sarah.
Suki attracted the attention of one of the resident felines who came like running in like, me? No. Mm-hmm. She baked herself so that you could live. This is how you use a chicken to make a point in a sitcom. Mash, take a note. Just kidding. It's too bad there's not a chicken in the next episode that we're discussing. I watched Strangers with Candy when it was on and then like failed to think about it ever again. When it wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was actually surprised, just refreshing my memory about the show generally, that it did have 3 seasons. I felt like it went on a lot longer and I just sort of fell away from it, but I think I did watch the whole thing. Mm-hmm. There are some slurs that are like, even though you know that the point is to like to satirize her and her whole thing, it just is like, oh, ow. But generally, it's like a really good mix of effective parody, like effective parody of what it's parodying. Mm-hmm. Surreal shit, stupid wordplay, like the stew thing. the woman who plays her mom, is it her actual mom? Her foster mom? I don't understand exactly the relationship, but that woman is amazing. Like the delivery of good biscuit blocking, I like had to pause it and just laugh to myself. It was amazing. Yeah. This was like, it was good and enjoyable to watch, but it was also kind of like a time machine, like to go back 20 years and see what sort of not edgy, but like just different, not sitcom-y sitcom comedy mm-hmm. was looking like at yep. that time, because this was really like bleeding edge shit that yep. seems kind of not expected now, but like, I don't know, like there was really nothing like this at the time. And I think this is a progenitor of a lot of things that we watch and enjoy yep. now, but it has also aged, with the exception of some terms, better than you might expect, given that it is like this foremother of other things. So mm-hmm. yeah, I enjoyed it. And that presentation was amazing. Dave.
Yeah. You can see like Community in this.
Yep.
You can see like some of the anti-comedy shows like Tim and Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's elements of that in there too.
Yeah. So obviously yeah. her show, her entertaining show on True TV.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
At Home yep. with Amy Sedaris.
So yeah, it is an interesting sort of bubbling pot of a whole bunch of things. And there are elements which I never, ever liked and always put me at ill ease. And it's usually to do with Jerry's family, like the grandpa that it never moves and has his mouth open all the time. And yeah. like the brother who is like a one note murderer of terrible things about Jerry. Like they're not awful. It's just like there was something about that sort of like put its hand on my forehead and I was trying to walk forward. It's like, you can't like this all the time.
Right.
And I felt like they were just adding things that were weird and different. And then some of them hit and some of them didn't. Some of them hit like Onyx Blackman eating potatoes with caramel on it out of his fondue pot at the start. Like, and then like there's callbacks to it. Everybody goes like, oh, I never had caramel on a potato before.
Mm-hmm.
Like just weird things like that always tickle my fancy. Like I like it when they can do things like that. But there's elements of this that kind of push you back to very, very of its time, especially like the graphics for the intro and stuff. Like it's everything about it is, if you just were like 3 years later, it would have been like, you would have turned the corner on technology for this kind of stuff. It's just very of its time, right? Trapped in a moment. It's funny and I enjoyed it, but I felt like this whole show is like 70% of what I want it to be at all times, right? Like
yeah.
I just kind of feel like it's never quite at full speed.
Right.
Even at the time, I felt like, as Sarah said, it was very avant-garde for its...
Then.
Yeah, then.
Yeah.
Not so much now, but as you can see the styles of comedy that it was trying to blend in other things.
Yep.
But it just never felt like it was firing on all cylinders at full speed all the time. So while I enjoy a lot yeah. of Strangers with Candy episodes, like I just don't think it's a show that had a formula that worked well enough for any of its episodes to be canon worthy. Although they are, for me, enjoyable, although I remembered them being quite hit and miss, these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But that squirrel one you're talking about, I do remember really liking that one a lot, yeah. even though I don't remember what the hell it was about.
I don't either.
But
that's squirrel, all I remember.
Strangers with Candy, Onyx Blackman, they're all in my head swirling around and they're activating pleasure zones. So.
Yeah, someone's going to tell us on Twitter, yeah. or maybe we should revisit it after we're done recording.
Yeah. All right, so let's put this to the vote. Tara?
I'll vote yay.
Sarah D. Bunting?
I will also vote yay.
I'm going to say marginal no for all those reasons, but it doesn't matter because... Strangers with Candy, Season 1, Episode 7, Feather in the Storm. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon. It's time for our third show picked by me. Let's hear that argument.
Hello, it's Mademoiselle Caroline. Today I'm submitting season 2, episode 3 of the British sitcom The IT Crowd. This is the episode with the German cannibal. I picked this episode after a lot of deliberation with myself because there are a lot of iconic moments in this series, and for example, this episode doesn't even contain the running joke of, have you tried turning it off and on again? However, it does have the following quote, which is my personal mantra. People, what a bunch of bastards. I do feel it's a very strong episode on the whole, so here are my reasons why I think this is canon-worthy. Number one, the episode takes place in 2007 and addresses several issues of the mid-aughts for us Europeans at the time that included England, like those terrible anti-piracy ads on DVDs. So for the youngest out there, at the time we watched our entertainment on DVDs, and even on the legally purchased ones, we had to suffer through long and irritating warnings about why piracy is a crime. And you couldn't fast forward it. So the episode starts with a parody of those ads narrated by Matt Berry, as you can hear in clip one.
You wouldn't steal a handbag. You wouldn't steal a car. You wouldn't steal a baby. You wouldn't shoot a policeman and then steal his helmet. You wouldn't go to the toilet in his helmet and then send it to the policeman's grieving widow and then steal it again. Downloading films is stealing. If you do it, you will face the consequences.
These anti-piracy ads are getting really mean.
Reason number two. I personally sympathize with Roy in this episode as he tries to watch a movie before somebody tells him about the surprise twist in the plot. In 1995, I was in my car going to Paris to go see The Usual Suspects when a fucking journalist on the radio told a twist for all to hear. I still bitch about it to this day. So I understand his frustration when, in his efforts to watch the film as soon as possible, he decides to accept his boss's invitation to watch it at his place, which turned out to be a mistake. Clip number two.
Oh, I've heard of this flick. There's a twist in it, isn't there? Yeah. Just try and forget that, and hopefully we'll still be able to enjoy it.
I bet he's a woman, that bloke. No, you think it's the future, but it's actually set in the past. It's not Earth. It's all a dream.
Oh, could you not try and guess what the twist is?
That might get a little annoying.
They're all clones. He's his own brother. Everyone's a ghost.
Number three. The B-plot is a bit weaker, but it involves another preoccupation of the mid-aughts, the smoking ban. Reality is a bit elastic, as Dave would say in this sitcom. For example, Moss participates in illegal secret duels for fans and contestants of the TV program Countdown, which is the most boring, only watched by senior citizens game show ever. Here, Jen has to deal with the indoor smoking ban, which slowly transforms her into a sort of a USSR woman banished to an apocalyptic wasteland for smokers. But number four, the real meat of this episode is Moss's misunderstanding when he tries to join a German cookery class, only to be told that he's supposed to be the main course, since the German gentleman is in fact a cannibal. I enjoy how everyone stays polite throughout, the German man dealing with his disappointment when Moss refuses to consent to be eaten, and eventually enjoying a viewing of Ocean's 11 together. A fine young cannibal indeed. According to IMDb trivia, this is based on a real case. Also, Richard Ayoade is probably my favorite British comedian. Here, there's a sort of sweet innocence to his character, but I also love his natural, dry delivery style. Seek out on YouTube the episodes of the Big Fat Quiz of the Year when he participated. He's so deadpan funny. And finally, number five. The ending has a twist within a twist. And even though it goes against my and Roy's principles, I will reveal them. when Moss and Roy decide to go back to the cannibal's house to enjoy watching their movie on his big screen TV, they are interrupted by the police, who are not, it turns out, here to arrest the German fellow, but them for owning a bootleg DVD. And then Roy actually slaps the detective in the interrogation room as he's about to disclose the twist in the film. The slap being a perfect ending punctuation to a very funny and silly piece of British and Irish humor, in my opinion. But did you enjoy it too?
Thank you, Mademoiselle Caroline. A little saucier than usual. I like that.
Yeah. English swears. I'm in.
The IT Crowd, a show that I've heard about for a long time and in the ether, and it felt like on paper something I would enjoy, right? Maybe it's a dry British comedy about IT people. I like IT. I'm kind of quasi-IT. It's certainly IT in this house and among peers and family. So we watched the pilot, maybe the pilot in the first episode. Oh, boy.
We still lived in New York a long time ago.
Long time ago. Let's say 8 years ago or so. And it didn't click. Like, it just seemed very, it seemed too broad, are you having a laugh from extras? You know, it was just like too catchphrasy, too all this stuff. This episode is a lot better. The opening with the piracy thing, genuinely, like, laugh out loud, funny.
Which we think is Peter Serafinowicz doing the
voiceover. It sounds like him, but he's not credited on this episode.
He might have done it anyway, though.
He's credited on three other episodes.
I bet it's him.
Voiceover stuff. So I don't know why, if he's on that one, he's not on this one, but it really sounds like him more than
that's not Matt Berry?
No, I don't
think it's him. Sounds more like Peter Serafinowicz to me, too, but I have nothing to back that up. So I think she might be right.
All right, well.
Tara does not accept this.
I'm backing down.
Tara says it's Darth Maul or it's nothing.
I'm backing down.
So I enjoyed this episode, and boy, cannibals that put advertisements out for people that would like to eat them. What a moment in time that was. Do you remember? Like, it's very.
That was a famous case. It's funny that she said, and according to IMDb, like, yeah, that was a known thing. That's funny that one missed her.
Yeah. My problem with this episode, and I guess probably the show as a whole, is I want it to be less broad. I want it to be more like a Veep in the Thick of It sort of drier. Like, we're now rewatching in this house all the Alan Partridge shows. And I feel like Alan Partridge is halfway between this show and In the Thick of It as far as like how broad it is and then how dry it is.
Yep.
And like, if you can imagine that whole Russian bleakscape storyline with all the smokers who are exiled to, you know, Smoker's Island as more of an Annucci tinged writing, I feel like it would be way funnier, at least for me, for my taste. Would the show be as popular? Probably not, but I would enjoy it more. Like, I feel like they're so close to that show, but it's just still got one foot in the laugh track and, you know, the live audience kind of stuff. And it really hurts it. Like, or if not like Annucci stuff, like for, let's say, Arrested Development, like something more towards that style, I think would have been better for the show. A lot to recommend. Matt Berry's in it. He plays the owner and billionaire or something like that. He's
the
muckety
boss.
Muck. Yeah. There's so many pieces that feel right, but it just doesn't quite all come together in a way that I feel like I would have put a canon stamp on it. But it's close and I like it. And we watched it and was like, oh, that's so much better than the ones we watched. We should continue after this and like give it a few more episodes to see if it keeps up, you know, this pace, because that was funny. Just presentation could have been so much better. I think there's more potential for this show than they put on screen.
We have been getting to know Catherine Parkinson, who plays Jen this season on Taskmaster, which we have been flying to England to watch. And she is a hilarious goof. And Sarah, in real life, she is married to Ray Bloody Purchase. That's your more British comedy trivia for you.
That's
her. That actor is her husband in real life. So I was kindly disposed toward this because I knew she was in it. Speaking of ageless beauties, she looks exactly the same on Taskmaster, pretty much to me, as she does in this. And it was 13 years ago. I did think her storyline was the funniest. I thought it opened strong with that the spoof of the DVD, and it was like, okay, if it's more of like this is what I want. And then it just, I felt like, although the cannibal thing was obviously extremely outlandish, it just felt like it felt too long. It felt kind of flabby to me, because it's like, once you get there, okay, got it.
What's
right? Yeah. Exactly.
How? What's the next level?
Why
of
is
your
there
comedy?
More yeah. of this? Right. And it's just sort of like it was funny. It just felt like it needed to be pared down closer to the bone, if Stu will permit me, from Strangers with Candy or the German, for that matter.
Don't be a chicken. Say what you feel.
I agree with Dave. There was good stuff. And at the end of it, I said, this is, as Dave said, we should like maybe come back to this and start with like season three, because there's five seasons of this, which like for a British show, that's like a million seasons.
Well, this was season two, and it was
yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm saying like we should see how much more it evolved even further.
Gotcha.
Like if it continued to get. You know what
forward,
I mean?
Fast forward in time.
Exactly.
See where we are. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm very grateful that we got the chance to see that, like, oh, wow, there was a huge leap from the pilot to here. I'm curious to see if there was a huger leap from here to like later in the show.
Yeah.
What?
But do you agree that has like, are you having a laugh energy to it? That sort of.
Yeah. It feels like it's dumbed
you from
down.
Enjoying it.
Yeah. And when I saw that it was directed by Graham Linehan, I was like, oh, okay. That's the Father Ted energy that they're bringing to it. And he's in that comedy cadre as well. Yeah. Like he's in with Iannucci and all those guys from like way back.
I can see, yeah.
But he's bringing like the bad part. And we know that now because he's, you know, super duper canceled for being a TERF and everybody hates him, and rightly so. He's a bad person. But that, you know, leaving that aside regards to this episode, sure. I don't think it impinges on our vote here.
No.
But I agree. There's definitely funny stuff here. It just felt like it was a little bit overstuffed, and it felt like it was being written to fill a certain length of time. And now I'm doing it. I'm talking more than I should. I already said it needs to be shorter, so I'm going to stop. Sarah.
I was pretty sold on it by the end of the PSA, which like I immediately in my nose was like, oh my God, is that toast?
Yeah.
And then there he was and I was like, okay, here's the thing. Like I wrote down many funny lines. I thought there were a lot of good ideas, but Tara is right. Like some of them sort of needed to be just like glimpses. Like this didn't need to be its full runtime. Like I understand that it does, because whatever, the Beeb has needs, but like, as we've said, the cannibal thing, like, you know, once you've arrived at this, like do something else and or get out. And the you know, Russian, like, it's too Soviet out there. Like, okay, ha. But then, I don't know, like, then they're walking, and then there's, like, a follow-up scene that's sort of, like, explaining what's going on. It's like, okay, like, we're already there. Maybe this is something, like, we were talking about before, where we are, you know, conditioned as TV watchers of some vintage, and particularly, you know, comedy watchers, that it's like this has been done better and more quickly since then.
Yeah.
So we're sort of conditioned for it to be a little better toned, like you said.
Right. Like they get by the they say it's a little Soviet out there. Got it. And then when we see her in the next scene and she's putting on the scarf, it's like, okay, that's the escalation. Got it. And then they put a hat on a hat.
There was just like another faster way to do it.
Yep.
And they didn't do it that way.
Yeah.
But my main thing here is like the laugh track is fucking unbearable.
Mm.
It's unbearable.
Yeah.
And I just kept wondering, like, is there any way to separate this out, because it's not necessary. Like this is, I mean, again, like I'm conditioned to sitcom rhythms, good and bad. I understand what's supposed to happen. Like it just was that extremely noisy Norman Lear volume reactions. That's like, you can't take it out, but it just like banged it down like two half letter grades, basically, that it was just like, oh my God, it's endless.
That should be a feature on like streaming.
Turn off the turn off the laugh track. Yeah.
Turn off the laugh track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it just was, and that might have added, like, not a ton, but it might have added to the runtime, and that might have, like, without that, they might have been able to Arrested Development it so that it just, like, flowed a little better, and it might have, you know, pointed out certain things in the script that it's like, oh, I think we could cut this.
Well, the problem with the laugh track is signaling what the show and the creator thinks are the funniest things, right? And sometimes it's not, and it plays into that, like, it's too loud, it's too ready to be enjoyed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the laugh track plays into that a lot.
Yeah. I feel like what we can see just parachuting in at this, you know, relatively midpoint of the show is like what the comedy comes from on this show is the interplay of these characters. It's not the situation so much. It's so like, give us more of them. Like the part of them being in the terrible apartment trying to watch the movie, like that's that was a funnier scene than anything else that happened later. I mean, it's obviously teed up by the PSA, but like it tells us so much about their relationship and those characters. And like, you know, it just all of that is character based. It's not situation based. So like get out of the way of the characters interacting. Just let them do that and stop with the other stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. And there were some callbacks to that stuff, like that he's in someone else's apartment and he's like, the TV is the correct distance from the couch. That's like, and then the laugh track sort of like doesn't notice that. And you're like, oh, that was a nice bit of business that, but then the laugh track stampedes back in and oh my God, it really thought the cannibal playing the cello was hilarious. And I was just like, I watched the entire series run of Hannibal and analyzed it in some detail. Like this is, I don't know, like this is an expected note and we have to wait for everybody to stop busting a gut so that we can move on to the next thing, which we don't need to be doing.
Right.
I'm making it sound like I thought this was a C+. I didn't, but the laugh track is really extremely difficult for me to get past. And I'm not sure how I'm going to vote because I mean, like Matt Berry, just like, she's a clone. They're all clones. He's his own brother. Like just so funny. And then Chris O'Dowd just like, squirming because he's trying to like, please don't do that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, there are really funny bits in here, but it's like, yeah, like Dave said, it's just not, it's not quite there.
Yeah.
So I too am curious to see if you guys like drop in series four, if it's reached like peak density. So
yeah,
let me know.
All right, let's put this to the official vote. I will go first. I'm going to say enjoyed it, but not canon worthy. Tara?
I'm going to vote the PSA spoof into the tiny cannon, but it's a no for me.
And Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah, what Tara said. Very close. Excellent presentation, of course, mademoiselle. Merci. But it's a no.
All right. That means the IT crowd. Series 2, Episode 3. And I'm trying to remember the title because it actually has one. I think it's Loss in the Germans. You are hereby not, unfortunately, inducted to the Extra Hot Recap.